All right, sweet. Then let me give us a sync. Hello. We are sitting here with Irene. And I'm going to just kick it off right to you. And if you could tell us who you are, what you do.
Yes, thank you. I'm Irene Tellorista. I'm a second year student at the Political Science and International Relations Department here at CU. And I'm studying corruption. I used to run an NGO in Mexico for 5.5 years, and we studied impunity and corruption in Mexico. And I just wanted to learn more about how we can use different methods to understand corruption networks with data. And I think that's what I'm doing right now.
Cool. And second year of PhD.
Yes, second year of PhD.
So you had quite a number of years becoming an expert in sort of the field. And then you went in to learn a bit more tools to be able to apply that to the field.
Yes, I also got a little bit burned out, I think. I think dealing with the kind of topics I deal, it's super hard. And the stories we uncovered in Mexico were sometimes really, really terrible stories. And I think I also wanted to give myself a little bit more space to keep doing the job that I do, that I think it's super important. But I think if we, the persons that deal with these topics, also get ourselves left in the struggle, I think it's not good for anyone. So I also wanted to give a little bit of a perspective.
Cool. And because we're so much outside of it as cognitive scientists, can you give us a, what does the job entail?
Right now or before? Or the two?
Wow. First before.
I think before it was about, yeah, trying to uncover corruption case in Mexico, like how they happen, what kind of mechanism corruption networks use to not only diversify the public funds, but also to money, like launder the money that they get from this corrupt scheme. So it was a lot about thinking about topics that would resonate with people at first. We did a lot of analysis of corruption in the health system, because for us it was the best way to let people understand that corruption is a big issue and how it can actually translate into a human rights violation. So for example, we also say corruption kills and violates human rights, and it's not only does this is something that we're saying it because it sounds like a catchphrase, it's actually true, because when you look at how, or what we looked at was how shell companies were being used to diversify public funds from the Mexican public health system, and they did this in all over the country for many years. It didn't matter the administration, the political party, and what we saw behind this was this impunity, because I think because they know they can keep doing it and nothing happens, that's how you. So it was basically trying to understand like what would resonate with people, how we could actually uncover, because of course corruption is made in a way to try to not left any traces. So it's what kind of information we could actually get to prove these stories. And then we always try to make something happen. So we work with a lot of lawyers also to try to make litigation involving these corruption cases. So it's not only this feeling of you cannot do anything about it. It's like, we're uncovering this. Please, authorities, try to do something about it to make it stop.
And the organization was Transparency International, right? Is that right? Or
no, it's crazy because I'm a philosopher by training. So
right.
the first place that I started working in corruption was in the Mexican chapter of Transparency International in Mexico. And then I got more and more and I just became passionate about it, because I also come from a background where middle-low economic background. And I saw, all the inequalities I experienced living up translated also in a way into corruption, and how, because of corruption, a lot of people don't have the public services that they actually need to have. So that was the first place. And I did my master's in New York. And then I returned and we founded this new NGO that completely dedicated itself only to corruption and impunity cases in Mexico. So that's the one I was working on, and it was called Zero Impunity in Spanish.
So you did a bachelor's in philosophy,
yes,
and then a master's was in?
International relations.
And now it's?
Political science, public policy.
interesting mix of things. So what are you doing right now? Can you explain to us a little bit?
Yes, right now I'm working on how you can use administrative data sets, that's how it's called, like public procurement data sets, beneficial ownership registers, to actually uncover corruption risks. So I'm very fortunate because I'm working with one of the lead experts of the field in this, that he's called Mihai Fashekas. He's a professor at CU. And he did a lot of work on trying to develop corruption risks indicators because, like I told you, of course, you're not going to actually expect to see this database and say, like, hey, this is a corruption case. You have to actually try to find out ways where you can actually try to uncover corruption networks with this data. So he did this indicator. So, for example, for public procurement, when you the government has to buy something or acquire services, then you can see, okay, for this process, it was only one company that participated, so it's only one bidder. The time between when it was announced and it was actually given the contract, it's too little, so it seems like it was kind of tailored. This kind of indicators, and now we're doing another kind of indicators about how ownership risks could also be identified.
So let me see if I understood correctly. So you're saying indicators, but you're talking about kind of like tools of prediction. If looking at the data, it seems like that this could lead to a corruption case, or you're actually investigating if there is a corruption case behind it. Is it what is?
Since we're in academia and we have to have like ethic regulations, right now it's just like, yeah, possible. You always talk about possible cases. What I would love to do is what I was used to doing. Like, of course, you develop these indicators of possible corruption cases, but then you work with other people that can actually do something about it. So, for example, a journalist that could look into these cases deeper to see what was actually going on, or public enforcement officials that could actually have like this risk-driven methods that it's much easier for them to just run the databases and say, okay, we have this risk about this, let's look into these cases, then expect people to be reporting these cases, which is actually how they usually worked. So I think it's now the part of what we can actually do with the data and how the patterns that we're seeing, how we're seeing like corruption networks evolving and transforming and what kind of traces they leave in the data. Mm-hmm. But of course, in the end, I hope that this is something useful for people to dedicate themselves to this. Mm-hmm. About the prediction, this is how the field is evolving with all this artificial intelligence in place. Like, they're also trying to get this, or at least I'm also trying to work this, like how you can actually, from the data that you have, databases, train algorithms to say, okay, if I have this database where I see certain companies that were politically connected depending on this financial registries, could I actually predict if I put new companies, which are the companies that have political connections? This is a work we're also working with Mishi, that's how we call him, Professor Fashekas, and people at the World Bank that has been doing this work in Bulgaria, and that I actually let me use their database to train this algorithm to try to see if we can actually run some prediction on.
That's super interesting. That was exactly my question. If the corruption already happened, or if you're trying to prevent it to happen.
And I think it's both.
Yeah, cool.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess training the model on the fact, the context in which you know that that's the case, and then seeing if it can predict. So it's not just the statistical analysis that you're doing. You're actually training sort of artificial intelligence models, AI models, to be able to identify and highlight. That's really wild. So one thing that had come up before is how do you ensure that there's no overreach with these AIs? I remember you'd mentioned that's really important to you, to make sure that the tools aren't used to go after small-time folks, but is really to tackle the systemic problems rather than people who are victims of the system and just trying to benefit in the way that they can.
I think it's important to know how this technologies work. That's why I wanted to do the PhD, because I used to work a lot with people that did this. So you just ask them a programming to say, like, please do this. And now that I'm actually training the algorithm and I know all the decisions that I'm putting into the algorithm, like I decide what to do with the missing data, what is happening, if I'm taking it out, if I have to do some kind of imputation, what kind of variables I want the algorithm to identify, if I'm going to do cross-validation and testing, what kind of machine learning algorithms I can actually do with the data. Like, all of these decisions are mine. And now that I'm seeing what it entails and how it's not only about the decisions that the person takes that is programming this material, but also the quality of the data that you have that determines the kind of output that you have. I think that's indispensable for anyone that wants to have a take at this, that they know what the actual process looks like. Because now I'm hearing more and more people, for example, yesterday in Mexico, people talking about how they can actually prevent shell companies being used to diversify public funds if we have more AI systems. And I was like, do these people really know what they need to actually do this? Like, I think these are questions that we always have to take into consideration. I mean, I wouldn't say like let's not use it or it's a danger or, but I think we have to be cautious about it and not say or talk about this like this is going to save the world. And I just think we have to have a very balanced view on things. And I'm actually now talking with a lot of people that are working with this, a lot of women also, because I mean of course women and men can also have this, but I was just reading about this OpenAI and how they took the two board members out of the board because those were the ones that telling them, okay, this is incredible, but just we have to be also careful about what we're doing with these technologies. So I think it's very important that you actually see how these technologies work to get a more sense of what could actually be done with them.
Yeah, and could you give us just a couple more details on the types of data sets that you're pulling? Just where they're coming from, and then what kinds of things are, say, the most important types of information. If you don't have them, you're like, okay, this is the backbone of the data that we're trying to build out.
Yes, and I'm also fortunate enough because I'm working with, I mean, I'm learning now also this, so I wouldn't want to see that I'm the specialist. I'm working with people that have been doing this, like Antonina Volkotrup. She's an amazing programmer based in Ukraine, and she uses this. So with her and with Mishi, we're working on a project for the Global Corruption Observatory that it's based in here at CEU. And basically, she's matching public procurement data sets from five European countries with beneficial ownership registers from these five European countries to try to identify what are some of the risks that we can also see in ownership? Because, of course, first it was the first wave of anti-corruption and data was about analyzing procurement data. So, okay, like I told you what Mishi did, like if you had just one bidder, if you have very short time, this indicator exists for a long time and have been working. But now we also have another data set that is called beneficial ownership registers that were created to try to let know people who are the actual owners of companies, who benefits from the companies, because of course they always try to hide this information. But we know that many companies comply with the transparency policies, but in a way they're putting like a nominee or a strawman. So it's in a way, again, like trying to see, okay, maybe these indicators of an owner that is very young could be a risk. Or this indicator of an owner that is based on an offshore country. And some of these indicators, we're trying to match them to also compare them with the risks of procurement data to see, okay, we're seeing these risks in procurement data, how they translate into the ownership structures of the companies that are actually winning those contracts.
Yeah, I maybe would like to take a step back and maybe take advantage of your philosophy background a little bit as well. As you might know, we are interested in human behavior, right? So what interests me on corruption, and I think I get the feeling, or I guess, that if I would ask you, where does corruption come from? What is it and why it happens? I believe that you would put the blame, that's not a word, but well, you would put the blame on the structures, right? The structures that society make it available. And I believe that would be your answer. I don't know, what do you think? If there is component, a human component in corruption that is enhanced by the structures, and that's why you would tackle the structures of the system, or how do you view that? With how does the scale pan to you between human incentives, attitudes, behaviors, and the structures and where they have to make decisions, economic decisions? Where does corruption come from?
I think it's also important that I explain that I'm studying grand corruption. When you analyze corruption, you can study petty corruption. It's called, it's people giving bribes to public officials. I don't know, this is called petty corruption. And I study grand corruption, which is when you have access to lawyers and accountants and people that I can actually set up a shell company to diversify millions of euros or whatever the currency you're analyzing it. I think it's important to differentiate these two kinds of corruption because I think it becomes a gray area when people think about this petty corruption as a way of rationalizing and saying, okay, this is good. Like, of course, like these poor people need access to public services. Like, would you, like, why would you go against them? When you're actually talking about massive resources that are actually being diversified for, from public resources that are actually affecting more the people that don't have access to these public services because the money has been taken away too. So for me, this is the first thing that I would mention. When I think about the incentives of why these people do it, and I think this also, I mean, I need to mention it. I was privileged enough to go to a private school in Mexico that is one of the best schools in Mexico City, but because my dad was a teacher there, so me and my brother have scholarships all of our education. And I had the same level of education than my peers, and some of my peers right now are involved in shady business in Mexico. And now that I'm seeing that, for me, it's like, if you know what are you actually doing and that the money you're taking away, it's actually taken from the poorest people and you have been privileged enough all your life and still do it, for me, then it's like, I think it's just not only a structure, I think it's a decision. I think it's a responsibility that we have to put also on these people. Because if you blame it also all in the structure, then it seems like nobody's guilty. Like, it's just the structure pushing you in that way. And I think not. Like, I also had the privilege of attending school with some public officials right now that are extremely good at what they do, like super honest. So for me, it's also a matter of how you decide to get into this business. Because like I told you, like, it's not, oh, I by chance founded 300 shell companies that diversify public funds from the Mexican public health system to actually benefit me and my family. Like,
Yeah, so you're making a case which I resonates very deeply, which is that sort of petty corruption is something people are forced into by a system, but grand corruption is something that's facilitated by a system and people choose to do. It's not really out of need because they typically have a lot of resources. Because you also bring up an important point, which is that when you move from petty to grand corruption, you're not just changing in the scale of money involved, but also the tools. Like the methods are very different. One is just money changing hands. The other one is systems being set up within, like corporations set up, things moving offshore, lawyers being involved. And so that's a really important thing because you need resource in order to be that corrupt, in order to do corruption on that kind of scale.
Yes, and that's why when I did the work I did in Mexico, like with this investigation about shell companies being used to diversify public health funds from the Mexican public system, and it was, I think, I remember, millions of euros that were actually, and we did the translation of what that would entail, and I think it was, with that money, 44,000 women in Mexico could get a breast cancer treatment. So that's the things that I think need to be translated. Like, this is not a victimless crime, unfortunately. This is not something that, okay, now these people have access to the best schools and the best vacations. No, they're taking away money that could be used to get people better public services. That's why I think we never have to lose sight of that. I would never say also like cancel culture, like these people are so evil. Like, I mean, this is a very complicated thing, but I think in a way, try to stop them because this money could get better use for the people that need more of these public services.
That's so powerful. The putting it in terms that we can understand, because we can get, okay, corruption, okay, that's a large amount of money. But when you put it in the real world example of what the alternative could have been, I love that you brought that up. When you're doing the work, like what comes to mind for me is, in the United States, if you have grand corruption, grand healthcare corruption, the FBI would be the one to be involved. Who's involved in Mexico? What is the organization? Who do you tell?
So we're also a federation. So basically, it depends on the level of government where the Corruption Act happens. We were investigating corruption at the federal and the state level. So basically, because at the federal level, then it's like the general prosecutor's offices. And at the local level, it would be like the local prosecutor's offices, because we also have this anti-corruption office, like, anti-corruption bodies that investigate only anti-corruption cases, depending if it's the federal or the local level. The problem in Mexico is the level of impunity that we have of also like the other corruption, which becomes the worst when you have also public officials that are responsible for investigating this crime, kind of in a illegal liaison with the people doing the crime, so they don't investigate as properly as they should.
Were there any safety concerns for yourself or the people that you worked with? I mean, how did you guarantee safety for people when they're attempting to prosecute crimes on people who are corrupt at that scale?
I think we did several things. We tried to always look at the pattern, so that's when it was safe. When we started signaling particular politicians, that when we started feeling like the tension of it, but then we tried to do a mix of both. Like sometimes we would definitely had to signal the persons involved in certain cases, and sometimes it was more like a general pattern about a policy recommendation, like, okay, this is happening because we don't have this in place to prevent this from happening and to do something about the people that are actually involved in this. So it was a mixture of those. Definitely, I think that was part of the burnout, because you have to be taking care not only about yourself, but your team, and given interviews with a lot of actors. Sometimes I would be speaking with the general prosecutor's offices. Sometimes I would be speaking in interviews or with people. So you also have to mold your tone because of the audience you're speaking to. Because, of course, what we wanted to generate with this was change, not someone closing you the door and saying, like, I don't want to speak with you anymore. Like, so it's pretty emotionally draining, but yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about the policy recommendation side, which, yeah, is probably even more important. There are individual actors that need to be addressed, but the policy changes are probably some of the bulk of the work. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I know very little about criminology, so I don't want to derail you, but I would come back to behavior. I don't know. It seems, well, hearing you, you're talking about big crime and basically bringing things to justice. The way that you say, I don't see a way that we can do any to make change from the bottom up. What do you think? Is there anything what's the perception, like what's the average perception of grand corruption of the general population, and what can we do about it?
Yes, I think that's why I also went more into data, because, I mean, I love philosophy and I love reading, but I think, and I have now a mixed methods approach, because when I got into these realms of nihilism where, like, everything is like this, like, what doesn't make sense? Then I went back to the data to get a little bit more grounded, and it helped me, because what we see, at least in Mexico, is that the change is actually coming from the grounds up. It's journalists taking the cases. It's civil society that is doing the work. It's citizens fed up with the system. I mean, of course, like, I wouldn't say, like, I at least thought that we were in a very good change of things happening in Mexico. It has been politicized and a lot of things are happening. But I still feel like a lot of people are involved in knowing more about these cases. And that's why I mentioned the data, because if you see the perception, and this is like the main indicator that people know about how corruption is being measured right now, is the Transparency International Corruption Perception Index. This is a perception. But the problem is that with perception, you're not actually seeing how much level of corruption you have. You're seeing how much people perceive. So in Mexico, of course, we always had like the highest levels of perception. Mm-hmm. And you usually, when you see it in the national level, like you make like a, yeah, like, what's the difference between Mexico City and the rest of the states? Mexico City had a higher perception level than the rest of the states, even though I'm seeing, of course, you could see more corruption in other states. That's because of the level of awareness that we had of the corruption cases. So I think it's important to differentiate between the perception that people have of corruption and being fed up and what could actually be done by people. So when I see like the level of, yeah, like people angry about corruption in Mexico, it's super hot, but I also see a lot of people trying to do something to uncover these corruption cases and to move in a place where we don't have impunity as a general rule with these corruption cases. So I think that's why I moved. Yeah, sometimes I feel like there's nothing to be done, and then I see all the people doing something about it, that it gives me kind of a hope.
Do you think there is, do you think people have a problem on understanding the value of public goods? I think in your case, there is a problem of scale that you mentioned a couple times already, that the scale is so big, and we have to understand the scale. But in general, what I'm thinking about is just people do not realizing what they are losing in terms of the public goods, right? So it's a little bit abstract, right? I don't think as a species we evolved to understand a scale of a country as generating resources that should be shared by everyone. So that there's a very big distance there from what we can grasp. And maybe that creates some certain of problem of mismatch of or basically understanding how much you're losing when these kind of things happen. So just pretty simply, like, people would justify, well, yeah, if you have power and you can get money, I don't care. That's what happens. That's the general, that's the natural course of things, right? I don't think that everybody would justify, but there will be people that would justify like that, and they don't understand how much they are losing in the process, because there is a lack of, there is a distance between perceiving what is good for you and what's good for everybody and what's at stake. So I don't know if you would have any comment or agree with that, that it's hard to understand the value of public goods.
I think that's why at least me and my organization always made a great effort of telling stories. I think with the story, you can actually understand better the problem and not just get this. Yeah, because if I tell you millions of euros were diversified, like, it doesn't tell you anything. If I tell you exactly how it could actually translate into health services, into the lives of people, I think then you get it. So for me, I've always been a passionate storyteller. And I think if we don't have the capacity to tell these stories, then we don't have the capacity to make people care about these issues, because it's not only something that we should be caring, it's something that we all as a society we should be caring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that resonates deeply as a poet and storyteller. I think that we have a capacity to understand through comparison, context, contrast in ways which we cannot grasp the abstract. So I think that's super cool that you guys have done that. What do you have people on the team that you specifically curated to be able to tell stories in a particular way, or what do you look for when you're trying to build a narrative out of a piece of information that you've gathered or generated?
I mean, I think I was fortunate enough to assemble a team of very young, multidisciplinary people. So I worked with lawyers, with people from communications, a lot of lawyers, programmers, and I think we always try to make an effort to each of us bring in the own perspective, because of course when you get trained into a particular field, you see the world in a certain way. So for me, it was important to try to get a sense of all the team, what we're seeing on of this story, how we can actually pull it out. And yeah, sometimes you have to also look into how get media interested in your stories, because it's not like we're doing all this work so nobody cares. So I think we try to do a balance of trying to get a sense of this story, how could it be told from different perspectives, and how can we make people care about these cases, that it's not only us But yeah, I think I was just fortunate enough with working with amazing people that I miss every day, but I know they're fine.
Yeah, so I guess one other thing to pull it back a bit towards behavior again is one of the things that I think we see is, we see this in at least climate and environmental policies, which I was a lot more involved in before coming into academia for cognitive science, which is that when people are optimistic about a system, they seem to be more willing and engaged to cooperate in the system or to engage in the system for the greater good. And there are a lot of these programs that, that governments, local governments usually try putting in place where they clean up all the trash, that all the litter that has been in place, and then people stop littering. It's this very interesting thing where when people see that the government and other people are not taking for granted what they have, they also are willing, more willing to contribute to the system. It's sort of a way to remove the roots of this fallibilist, nihilist sort of perspective and gets people to be a little bit more optimistic about their ability to contribute. And my sense is that maybe with corruption, it might be something similar where, yeah, maybe the individuals might still be required to engage in petty corruption until the systemic factors and grand corruption goes away or is reduced. But maybe with things about people being more vocal and less willing to take for granted that corruption is the status quo that is unchangeable, maybe you can get larger scale change. But to that fact, what can an individual do to aid in the effort against grand corruption? Because if you're trying to aid in the effort for fighting climate change, the behaviors are simple. I mean, you stop buying certain things, change the behavior, recycle, don't litter, all these things. What do you do to fight grand corruption if you're just an individual?
I think there's many things you can do. What I used to say before, it's first of all, sharing the work that organizations like mine used to do helps a lot because, of course, we try to reach as many people as possible, but we have a certain reach. So if people help us disseminate the work we do, that, like you said, like maybe not everyone has to be an anti-corruption specialist, but they can help us to tell these stories and tell why it's important. Now that many countries are having elections all over the world, if they get a sense of the kind of anti-corruption policies that are being proposed, if it makes sense or not. And again, it's not that they become the specialists, but sometimes many of the small NGOs like mine, we did a lot of effort to try to bring material so people knew about what was a good anti-corruption policy, what it entailed. So just getting a sense of the issue, I think it's a huge thing. Donating to these causes, like the funding we have to do these jobs is super limited. I think that could also be a good thing to do. And I think just having these conversations like right now, like we're having, like this issue I get all the time about, like if it's corruption, it's justifiable or not, like if it's a good thing or not, because like I told you, I think it's a very gray area where people are more used to this petty corruption. And with this understanding they have, very easily say it's okay, this grand schemes when they don't actually know what's involved. Because when I explain people all the resources that, like you said, like they have accountants, programmers, lawyers to actually get this mechanism in place, like I think it's they change the perspective about what's actually going on. So I think there's a lot of things that we can do. And this also because I'm worried that I think we have heard so much of corruption lately that people get fed up. So I think they noise out anything that has to do with corruption. So it's like, I don't want to know anymore. Like, I know it's happening. I don't want to care. And it's fine because I know life is hard. But sometimes, like, I would tell my friends, like, okay, I know you're not going to be dealing with the issues that I'm dealing, but at least help us in other ways. Like, help us spread the words. Help us spread about our jobs, about donate to these causes, maybe not mine, but other small NGOs or small journalists that are trying to do an amazing job. Like, I think there's a lot of way to help to this, that it's not only dedicating yourself to the issues.
No, that's wonderful. So what's the... You finished the PhD. What's the next step for you? Yeah, it's a tough question for any PhD, right?
Yeah.
But Is there like, I'm going to stay in academia for a bit and keep building these tools? Or are you thinking I'm going to go and directly try to apply this somewhere? Or are you thinking I'm going to be in Mexico immediately? Is there kind of a direction that you're going? Or maybe it's more like a 10 or 20 year sort of trajectory for you?
Maybe I'm going to go back into philosophy and start teaching philosophy to kids is what I think is going to save us. I mean, I don't know. I think that's why I also love working with my supervisor. I'm sending many flowers to him and many appreciation. But I think he has what I would imagine also like what I want to do, like have like a part that it's academic, but also part having a think tank or an NGO, because for me, these two things complement each other. Like I wouldn't be doing... I adore people that dedicate their life to theory, but for me, because I come from a very theoretical background, I always needed something that was also kind of applicable or that I could see the consequence that all the effort had to. So I also think I got into the PhD because I love teaching. I extremely love teaching. So if I could get a position where I can teach and still do this investigation that is more academic, more geeky, where you're just seeing what happens with the data, but in the way also translated to give recommendations to have more or better transparency policies in place, better anti-corruption policies in place, I think that would be a really good balance that I would like love to have at one point.
Yeah, I guess you kind of get to do the grassroots and increase your visibility, the visibility of the work at the same time. So that's a larger scale thing. That's really nice.
Yeah. Well, so you first, you see bad corruption and grand corruption as separate things. And for what I understood, there is also different motivations there, right? So with the bad corruption, maybe the individual is just driven by the structure. And
petty corruption.
Right. Okay. And with the grand corruption, there is something else that you said that you didn't want it to call that they are evil or something like that. But you believe that there is a difference on motivations there as well, right? And another thing that I want to ask is just how do you deal? Because for me, it doesn't seem it's not a one individual decision. Kind of can be. A lot of times probably is, but as you said, there is a whole structure that has to be, or a whole process structure has to be put in place, which accounts for a lot of people within this structure, right? There's everybody doing one part of the crime, right? So it's not one decision, it's many decisions being made. And one thing that I found interesting, I thought about that for a long time, it related to capitalism in general. But if you think it as a company, as an entity or an agent, which is composed by many agents, the company itself has one motivation, right? Which is profit and maintaining itself alive going forward. And then the individuals inside of the company, they do everything that they can to make the goal of this agent possible. So profit more or making more money out of it. So it's not a mean boss or a mean company owner. It's the entity itself and how it's built that drive the decisions of the individuals inside of it towards that goal. And companies, they usually have individuals inside of them that... helped policymakers to change certain legislations, everything within the law, actually. But they act in a way to give some certain advantage to that company. So it is a super organism in a sense, on where there's many decisions being made, and they converge towards a certain goal of this super agent, which doesn't exist. It's just just a network of individuals working together, and those decisions convert in something else. So I don't think even that it will be necessary to have an evil individual behind it. And I don't even think that in this sense, like individuals could be just within this decision-making chain worried about getting an increase in their salary, right?
We always speak almost of, or almost always, of networks of corruption, never of individuals. Individuals, when you speak about a legal case, because you have to be very careful about the responsibilities, because in the network, they don't have the same responsibilities. And usually with legal cases, you have to be very precise of who you are accusing of what to determine the kind of crime you're trying to get prosecuted. What you were talking about, the companies, I think you're talking about a legal or a good company. I don't know, I want to say a good company, but yeah, like when actually you have a lot of people working to, like you said, a common interest that could be profit, it can be many things. Actually, beneficial ownership registers were created because it was not companies, it was shell companies that we were created. So you were having a company created in an office in the Cayman Islands by some accountant that opened a company for you. The sole purpose of this company was to actually help you pay less taxes in your country or to money launder something money. So that kind of companies, because that's why it was important to actually see who was benefiting from them, because of course you were not going to put yourself as the owner of the company. You put a legal representatives. So in a way, what this transparency policy is trying to do is to make it harder for these people to use these legal vehicles that are called companies to this end. So, of course, when you have a lot of people working for a company, determining who the owner is may be not relevant. But when you have a company that's only on paper that was created in the office of someone, it's really important to see who actually benefits from this legal vehicle. So I think that's why you have different levels of responsibility. Yeah, I also wouldn't think about this evil person that has all the control. I think there's different incentives, different things. Like sometimes people do this just for a finance resource that they do want to pay less taxes. Like Shakira was actually almost convicted because of this, because I think she had, I don't know how many shell companies in her name. And I think it was actually a financial scheme that was put in place by her accountants to try to make her pay less taxes. But in the end, you're not paying taxes. So you're responsible. Well, I think you should be at least aware of the things your accountants are doing. So I think it depends on the case. I wouldn't want to say like this Kantian imperative categorical that this is always going to be the case in the corruption case. I think it's important to analyze case by case and to identify the responsibilities that each individual have in the network of corruption and the damage that it was produced. That's why I also talked to you about the damage. And now in the anti-corruption sphere, we're talking more about the victims of corruption, because of course, many times you cannot take a case of corruption into court because me as a citizen, I had to prove that I had been damaged directly by that corruption, and that's super difficult. So we're trying to talk about more about the victims of corruption. So NGOs that do litigation could actually say, okay, I found this, I'm going to be the victim of corruption, because if you're a victim in a crime, you usually have more intervention in how the process plays out than if you're just the people that try to report a crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't thinking about shell companies. The company was more of an example of what I was trying to describe. What you said is a network of corruption. So, and I think you put it very clearly that there is a hierarchical structure within those networks as well, so there's like a hierarchy of responsibilities. But what I mentioned as well is that everybody's getting some, everybody within the network, like corruption cannot be done alone, right? Never. Or there's always like different parts playing.
I think for grand corruption, yeah, definitely. And sometimes the people you see, which is, I think this is the part that it's evil. At least in Mexico, when we analyze some cases of shell companies, the people that were being reported as the owners are super poor people that would never have access to basic public services, that sometimes they went like, I need your a public ID, I'm going to give you some money, and I just need you to sign these papers. That's evil, like, because in the end, it's like, or using a middle manager that doesn't have involved, that those are the people that have to sign, because in the end, that those are going to be responsible in front of the law, even though the higher, their superior is the one commanding them to do this. Like, they do have very shady strategies in place to actually remove themselves from the chains of responsibility and not appear in this. And in the end, they are the ones benefiting from this, or the benefiting the most.
Wow, yeah, I wasn't even thinking about how some people who are not even to them, they're involved in some kind of like petty corruption. They might be getting a small payment, but they're just vehicles that facilitate grand corruption. I hadn't even thought about that. Are there any cases that you know of where, because you mentioned the 44,000 women that would be denied breast cancer treatment. Are there any cases where people have taken something like that, like a grand case, and said, we've all lost out because of this corruption, and tried to make a lawsuit like that?
Yes, we've been trying, and this is also a horrible case, but, well, in the end, we had a good example, but so you can see how operates corruption. That's why when I get to this issues of responsibilities, for me, it's like, no, these people knew what they were doing. Like, it was not like an accident of the structure. We did the investigations of shell companies, and then when we released that investigation, it was the starting of COVID pandemic in Mexico. So everything shut down, and then because we tried to make a policy recommendation of how to stop using the shell companies, we started talking to a lot of people involved in the health system in Mexico, and they told us, like, forget about that. Like, that's not even an issue. Look at what's happening with the scarcity of medications right now in this government. And a lot of people mentioned it. So we started analyzing, and then going to your point, the doctors, the network of doctors that looked or treated children with cancer in Mexico looked at the lawyers we were working with because they wanted to do something legal as a representative because they didn't have access to the treatments for the kids. So they were super desperate that they were actually seeing kids die because they didn't have access to the treatments, and they wanted to do something legal so they had access to the medications again. So in many countries, this kind of legal litigations take years to do it. So in the end, we started that litigation. We won now. But in the meantime, we started analyzing what was happening. So why we had sudden, like, you always hear about scarcity of medication in Mexico, but not like that. And then we found out that the now ruling party decided to change how they purchased the medicines in Mexico because they had some rive with the distributors, and they decided they could do it best and save money. And in the end, they completely destroyed the way that medicines were purchased and distributed in Mexico. So that's why we were seeing. So it was a problem more acute with cancer patients because they decided to ban the principal producer of chemotherapy in Mexico. So we were finding out this, and then in the meantime, trying to take this legal case so the children could have access to the medications of cancer. A lot of people die. More and more, I think we're seeing this, that depending on the topic where you see corruption, people trying to unite efforts to do a legal action because, of course, at least they, being the representatives of all the doctors that were actually treating cancer patients, children cancer patients in Mexico, it was also a way of them to protect them because the government was also going individually to doctors that said, this is a problem, like, we are facing this. So they, as a group, were safer to be represented and also had access to what was actually happening in a lot of hospitals in Mexico. So that was part also of the legal strategy that was involved.
Wow. I also had one more question about, you brought up like a tax evasion case, right? And that's an interesting thing because I don't think we separate too much in our heads the corruption that involves denying money into the system versus the corruption involved with misusing the money that comes out of the system. And so tax evasion is denying the government funding, which people might even maybe psychologically justify, rationalize, because they're like, well, the government's so corrupt. Why would I give this money? And maybe I could even see myself as a Robin Hood figure if I evade taxes and then try to do my own thing. But then you have when the government is actually giving money to an institution and then they are misusing those funds. So how do you make the distinction? Because this is how I'm naively making the distinction in my head.
Now when you go more into detail with criminology, you have to make the distinction because sometimes the patterns are different, sometimes not. For example, shell companies are used for both purposes, for tax evasion and for corruption. I think it's important to differentiate, because usually it's not about only detecting what is going on, but then if you want to do some legal action, you have to be very precise about the kind of crime you're actually untangling, because there's different crimes for these things, and there's different authorities that sometimes look into these different crimes. So that's why I think it's important to make a distinction. But there's sometimes very easily put into the same category that it's financial crimes. So when you talk about financial crimes, you talk about corruption, you talk about tax evasion, about money laundering, and you usually talk about them because they have similar schemes and similar structures, even though, like, in the end, I think it's important to recognize the differences, because for legal action, for reporting mechanism, for telling the story accurately, I think it's important to differentiate, because also sometimes, and that's going to back to the company, these people act as businessmen, so they diversify the financial crimes they get involved. So it's not only about tax evasion, it's also doing corruption, but it's also doing the money laundering that you need to get the money again into the system.
A diversified corruption portfolio is a ridiculous concept. It's so absurd.
So the difference between petty corruption and grand corruption is only on the scale of the money, or how much money is being diverted. I'm just thinking about when powerful individuals steal consistently for a long time, kind of like little money. Is that sort of, does how powerful the individual is and how power they have to make that happen, it's anyhow can differentiate it from bad corruption? And is, like, you know, but I mean, would you put for example a lawmaker or a politician that employ ghost employees on his cabinet for 20 years. I'm not talking about anybody specifically here, but there is someone that have done that. But would you, is it the same? Just because it's not on the billions, probably after 20 years it is. I don't know. I don't have the numbers. But is it any different because he is a powerful individual, because he was voted there, and because he has a lot, like he has more means to make it happen, different from bribing a police officer for you to not get a ticket?
I think it is. I mean, of course, this is not definitions that are set in stone, but for example, if this public official that it's stealing a little bit of money, but in his position, abusing the entrusted power in him to actually steal, even though it's, I don't know how you said little, but for me, that's grand corruption. Yeah. If that same official runs a red light and gives money to a police officer, maybe that's petty corruption. That's why I think it's very case by case, because it's not only the person, it's the act itself. So these are definitions, I think, are super important, but I think they also need to be flexible enough to cover an array of categories and shady areas that we're covering. I mainly try to say that I study grand corruption because I think the responsibility and that you put into the individuals involved in the network, it's much different than when you talk about a citizen that just wrote. I mean, I'm not condoning it, and it has a lot of another set of problems that are involved with petty corruption. But yeah, like the mechanisms and methodologies that I'm studying are not used to describe this kind of phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Are there any cases that you'd be particularly interested in discussing, or any methods or anything that you've worked on that was particularly interesting that could give us a good example of the kind of stuff that went on?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the part when it gets geeky, no, and not so dangerous. Like the work that we're doing now with Antonina and Mishi for the Global Corruption Observatory here at CU, it's analyzing these two databases, beneficial ownership procurement process. So we're seeing interesting stuff that, for example, in the UK, it's more risky to be a young owner. It relates more to corruption risk indicators in procurement processes. And I think it was Latvia, that it was the older owners were the ones that posed more risk. So also this is very important because these risk indicators are context dependent. So you cannot have a risk indicator that it could be applied to any country. You have to very specifically tune it to what is actually the corruption regularities in the country in place. And for the same, like we had sometimes, Denmark had a problem with a particular type of owner that we didn't see in the rest of the countries analyzed. This is the things that we're seeing right now. And for the things that I'm doing right now with Michi also, but with Mark, Tobias Schiffauer of the World Bank, we're trying to analyze what happened in Bulgaria because they found out that in Bulgaria, at least, companies that had a political connection, meaning they had an owner or a director that had some political prominence in Bulgaria, were more prone to corruption risks indicators in public procurement. So now what I'm doing with the prediction database or the prediction methods that we're trying to see, okay, analyze the financials of these companies that were politically connected to see what could actually be like a mechanism of prevention if we try to see other companies. So I'm seeing like things, I mean, I'm still running the models and I wouldn't set this in stone, but for example, the age of the company is something that's coming out, something that has to do with the profitability of the company, like in comparison to other companies, because, okay, this is something weird because these companies that are winning the contracts are more productive than the ones that are politically connected but still winning the contract. So I'm seeing a lot of that also. The number of employees, so I can see, okay, maybe they are using not shell companies, but they're using small companies to actually win the contract, and then they're subcontracting many of the things they actually won the contract for. So these are the things that we're seeing that for me is super interesting to see, like how it can actually be seen in the data.
For sure. Yeah, the interesting sort of finer points of actually addressing it and discovering the corruption that's taking place, what the methods people are using. It's an interesting thing to geek out on because it's the ways in which people are breaking the law. But it is super interesting. I really dig it. If I can ask you maybe more to start wrapping up the discussion, why are you doing this?
I think I've seen like firsthand what happens when you have access to incredible resources. Like I was lucky enough, all my education has been free because of the scholarships I have won all my life. I've had access to the best education, I think, maybe not in the world, but a very good education. And the place where I grew up, the children I grew up playing in the streets with have so different lives than me. It doesn't make sense. It just makes sense because of the opportunities that I got. And I think that's not fair. And I think the only way we can actually make a more level field for everyone is if we understand the mechanisms behind a lot of people not having the same opportunities just because privilege. So yeah, I think that's why I do it.
Yeah, that's really beautiful work. And I mean, really all benefiting from the type of work that you and people in your field do. I really appreciate that.
Can you imagine a future without corruption?
No.
No?
Unfortunately not. I think that's a very human thing, and that's something that you were talking about. But I do imagine a world with less corruption. And that's, I think, a huge difference, and where people know what corruption entails. But also, I think we're in the verge of climate crisis, so I don't know.
but it's interesting. So basically it will be a process of constant vigilance and probing for adjustments within our society, basically.
Yes, and like you said, maybe it's a very human thing to do. I think just the level, the scale of it, the damage it does, it changes, and that's why I think we still need to research and do something about it.
Yeah, mitigating the risks and the fallout from larger corruption rather than trying to change the behavior of every single person. Yes. And getting everybody to stop. Because in as much as maybe it's a human thing, it's a thing that emerges from human beings when you have enough human beings, but is something that I think is not innate, maybe even far from innate from most human beings. And I think that's what gives me the optimism, is that anybody given circumstances is capable of petty corruption, But I think probably very few people, given circumstances, are capable of grand corruption, particularly when they're faced with the kinds of things that you're putting in front of them, which is the direct implications, the fallout from the type of corruption, the amount of people losing healthcare, the amount of people suffering, the amount of people actually dying in cases where they're denied drugs, where they're denied access to healthcare. And I think that that's such a powerful tool to appeal to people's empathy. And I think that that's an implicit hopefulness in people. And I appreciate when other people are also hopeful in people's empathy, that they place their hope in people's empathy, because I think that's such a powerful thing. And I think that more people are capable of being empathetic than not, even when they behave in ways where they ignore the empathetic side. I think appeals to empathy are super powerful. And I'm guessing that you probably feel the same way.
Definitely. I always, before, because I only not study, I studied corruption and impunity. And in Mexico, both cases are, and everyone told me like, why do you keep doing that? Do we have a reason for hope? And I was like, always saying like, yes, of course. Like, don't you see all the people? And I mean, this phrase that I think it's from a show in the US. I don't know. I'm terrible with names, but when you feel that you're losing hope, look at the people doing actually something and you're going to regain it. And that's always what I said. Like, you see all these people doing actually something, that for me, that's the reason for hope and not these problems that, of course, they're super complex and in many areas of our lives, but I see the people doing something about it and caring and feeling empathetic about it, and that's what keeps me going.
Hope is an active process, yes, instead of a passive one. So cool. All right, I think we can end it there. Thank you so much, Irene.
Thank you very much, Irene.
You're welcome. Thank you.